You know, these past 3 weeks, Carol and I have been up in Rochester, Minnesota, which is about 7.5, 8 hours sort of northwest of here. And we were there for 3 weeks. And the weather there was, we knew I would never want to live in Rochester because when we drove up there, we saw piles of snow 7 and 8 feet tall on the sides of the road. I said, man, this is somewhere I will never, ever live. But while we were there, the weather was pretty good. You know, it wasn't bad, sun, you know, had a little bit of rain, not a big deal, but most days warm, got through it, life was good, we got to do what we needed to do while we were there. But then we were to come home this last Wednesday, and we started to get the word that a winter storm was coming. And winter storms in Rochester are winter storms. They're huge. And Bob Davies called me on Tuesday. He said, Scott, you better get out of there. You know, it's Tuesday. You better leave early. Tuesday is coming Wednesday. I said, Bob, relax. No, he said, it's everywhere. And he said, you better get out of there fast. I said, Bob, all right, we got this, man. But thank you for sharing. All right. So I checked the weather, and there was this big winter weather storm coming. And they gave it a name. And you all know the winter storm's name was Winter Storm Wesley, after our grandson. So our grandson was coming to chase us out of Minnesota. And so we got up Wednesday morning, and we loaded our car Tuesday night so we could get out of there early as we could, like 9:30. And we started driving, and Carol drove first. And instead of going east to Madison, Wisconsin, and down south to Champaign, we decided to drive straight south on Highway 63 and then cut east eventually over Highway 74 to come home to Champaign. And so we got in the car, and the snow started to fall. And Carol was driving, and I'm holding on to the dashboard, and it's just coming down all around us. And so for an hour, we were in the snow, going really slow, falling behind a semi-truck. Semi-trucks make wonderful snowplows. Man, I love semi-trucks. That's the only time I like semi-trucks. And so we're an hour in the snow, driving in the snow. No, Carol's driving in the snow. And then we're another hour driving in sleet and rain, freezing rain. And then another period of time in rain. And then gray clouds. But then we got close to Champaign. The sun came out. And the world was at peace. And we knew we were home. But we had to drive through the storm to be able to get home. And this is Palm Sunday, the week before Easter, where the Christian world, we open our arms to the celebration of the resurrection of Jesus Christ. But you can't get to Easter morning, the excitement of Easter morning, unless you go through the pain of Good Friday. You can't get through the hope of tomorrow unless you deal with the pressures of today. You know, before you can say, oh boy, Jesus is alive, you have to say, oh no, Jesus is dead. You see, the light shines brightest against a backdrop of darkness. And hope is most overwhelming when it comes out of a sense of hopelessness. And the joy of a grave emptied explodes out of a grave that was once filled. And to get to Easter morning, Jesus had to go through a storm to be able to bring us home. But you know what? No one likes to go through storms alone. You know, you get the diagnosis, cancer. And if a person gets a diagnosis, hey, cancer, what they do, they begin to let other people know to begin praying for them and to reach out to them and to pray and be there for them. If a person's sort of introverted, they might let a few people know, hey, please pray for me or reach out to me, and I need you here for me. But if a person's really extroverted, they begin to ask everybody to pray for them and to send prayer requests to people they've never met before and ask people to pray for them they don't know, in churches to pray for them they've never been to before. But, you know, more is better, and so they want more people, and their strength in numbers, so they gather the numbers around them to gather strength because they're getting ready to go through a storm. But no matter who you are, every time we as human beings go through storms, we need people to go through the storms with us. And that's the way it is with Jesus. You know, He's the Son of God. He's God, but He's fully God, yet He was fully man. And He had come into Jerusalem riding on a donkey the week before, and the people have palm branches as He came down the road, and as a descending road, but as He came down the road on the donkey, the crowds came out, and they're waving the palm branches and singing Hosanna, blessed is He who comes in the name of the Lord. And so on each side they're raising palm branches, throwing their cloaks down in front of Him as Jesus is coming into town, and hysteria and excitement, the Messiah, the Deliverer is here. And for Jesus, it was the best day ever. But a storm was brewing. And before He went into it, He called His disciples around Him to gain strength from Him, because He needed somebody to go with Him into the storm. And we pick up our passage today from the book of Mark, chapter 14, verse 12. As He begins to gather His disciples for a meal. And so it says, on the first day of the Feast of Unleavened Bread, which was a Thursday, when it was customary to sacrifice the Passover lamb, which was part of their meal, Jesus' disciples asked Him, "Where do you want us to go and make preparations for you to eat the Passover?" Now I want you to hear those. Where do you want us to go to make preparations for you and us to eat the Passover? Have you ever worked with anyone or worked for anyone and all they ever did was bring you problems? You knew when they were coming to see you because they had a problem they needed you to solve. And all they ever bring is problems to you. It's like when I was a young man many years ago, a young captain in the Army, I was a battery commander, Bravo Battery, first at Fort Bliss, Texas. And I had a training sergeant. Now, he was a training sergeant. He's a sergeant first class E7, Sergeant First Class Taylor. He was my training sergeant. Great guy. Wonderful personality, very likable. And what training sergeants would do, they would set up all the training for the unit. If we had to go to the range to shoot our weapons, M16s, they would set the range up. If we had to do a physical training test, they would set that up. They would make sure we were all qualified with our qualifications, with our specialties and things we needed to do. Very important person, one of my critical staff. But I avoided Sergeant Taylor as much as I possibly could because Sergeant Taylor always ever brought me problems. And whenever he came in my office, he would always begin by saying, "Sir, we've got a problem." But Sergeant Taylor never had any answers, only problems. "I could use some answers here." And he'd come and, "Sir, we've got a problem." Oh, great, Sergeant Taylor. And I think he just did that to me to get me all excited. "What? What are you talking about? Who could do something so ridiculous? Who dropped the ball here? All at one time, I heard him coming down the hallway, and I said, "Oh no, here he comes!" I was going to hide under my desk because but I thought he would see my boots and probably realize I was there hiding from him. But always, ever, only thing he ever brought me was problems and no solutions. And this is Thursday morning. Now, this Thursday morning, the feast, the Passover meal was going to be Thursday night. And all the Jewish people, they would have spent weeks and months preparing for the Passover meal, making the arrangements, get the food together, having a place to meet, getting everything prepared for this very special sacred occasion. And this is Thursday morning. And they forgot to make the reservations. They let Jesus down and they come and say, "Jesus, we've got a problem. Where do you want us to have the Passover meal?" But Jesus didn't get excited. He didn't get crazy because they let him down. Never got upset about their mistakes, their shortcomings, their sin, because Jesus, He came to die and forgive sin. So, verse 13 says, "So He sent two of His disciples, telling them, 'Go into the city, and a man carrying a jar of water will meet you. Follow him, and say to the owner of the house, he enters.'" All right. Doesn't that sound sort of strange to you? Jesus, where do you want us to prepare the Passover meal for you? And Jesus tells them, "Go into a city and look for some guy carrying a jar of water and follow him into the house of the owner." And if I'm a disciple, I'm thinking, come on, Jesus. You know, what are we supposed to do with this? Why don't you just send us directly to the house? Why don't you just send us to the owner? Just send us right there instead of us telling them to look for some guy who's carrying a jar of water in this we've never met before, never seen before. We don't even know who he looks. What if there's another guy with a jar of water? How do we know he's not the guy with the jar of water? Or what if there's 5 or 10 or 50 guys carrying jars of water? This is Passover. Everybody's getting ready for the meal, Jesus. I'm thinking, man, Jesus, you can make this a lot easier, a lot cleaner. Just tell us to go to house number 231 on Judah Street and we'll knock on the door and talk to the owner. Man, I don't know, Jesus, if I'm going to get this done sooner rather than later, I'm being very direct about this. Jesus, why are you telling us to go find that jar guy? Jesus told them that this is the way He wanted them to do it. See, the disciples, not Jesus, had created this situation. They put Jesus in this situation and they've come to Jesus for help. And Jesus says, "Hey, if you want me to help you, this you're going to have to do it this way. This is what help looks like. Okay? So just go and do it. Simply obey me. Do what I'm telling you to do. Follow my commands. Now go find that jar guy." And sometimes in our lives we make a mess of things. I don't know about you. I've been there. I've made more than one mess in my life. And then go to Jesus and ask Jesus, how do I fix this? How do I deal with this? And so He tells us, "All right, do it this way." But we don't like that way, so we try to come up with our own answer. We try to rationalize, "Jesus, well, I'd rather do it this way, or I want to deal with this situation." But we know He's telling us, "No, Scott, you need to do it this way. This is how I want it done." And why, Jesus? Why? And Jesus, because I'm Jesus and you're not, and I want you to obey me and do it my way. But the story gets even better. Verse 14, for he says, and when you get to the house, say to the owner of the house, he enters, the teacher asks, where is my guest room where I may eat the Passover with my disciples? Say to the owner of the house, where is my guest room? Now, if this guy owns the house, that means he owns every room in his house, right? It's his house. He owns every room. So what in the world is Jesus saying, hey, go into this guy's house and tell him, hey, where is my room that I'm going to have my meal with my disciples? You see, Jesus does not own that house. Jesus didn't own any houses. No property, no land, no portfolio, no retirement plan. Man, he didn't own anything earlier in his ministry. Someone had said, Jesus, I want to follow you. And Jesus said to him, hey, all right, here's the deal. Foxes have their dens they live in, and birds of the air have their nests, but the Son of Man does not even have any place to lay his head. Jesus does not own anything. But the amazing thing about it, even though Jesus does not own anything, he has authority over everything. You see, because the next day, that Friday, this is Thursday night, that next day he would be standing on trial before Pilate, the Roman governor. And as they have a dialogue, you know, Pilate, the Roman governor, Jesus is there, beaten, chained. He says, Jesus, where do you come from? And Jesus didn't answer. And Pilate said, don't you know I have the power to set you free or to crucify you? And Jesus said, you would have no power at all unless it was given to you from God. You see, that owner of the home, he thought, really believed that he owned his home. But the only reason he had a home is because God gave it to him. You know, we feel our lives are our lives to live as we see fit, to do what we want to do. But the only reason we have any life at all is because God has breathed into us the breath of life. You know, we say, hey, I've got all these skills and talents and I can do all this awesome thing and I've spent all these years studying and learning and developing and I'm going to go out and I'm going to change the world. I'm going to do what I want to do the way I want to do it. But you know, God is the one who gave you your skills and gave you your talents. You would have no talent at all. I would have no talent at all, no skill at all if God had not given it to me and blessed me with it. And because God has given it to us and God has given us life. And God, and we say about our futures, what is our future? What am I going to do and how am I going to live? But there will be, we would have no future unless God opens it up to us and allows us to step into it. Jesus owns nothing, but he has authority over everything. And the teacher asked, where is my guest room where I may eat the Passover with my disciples? He will show you a large upper room, furnished and ready. Make preparations for us there. And the disciples left, went into the city, and found things just as Jesus had told them. So they prepared the Passover. Jesus was getting ready to step into the storm, to go to the cross. And he brought his disciples around him to help give him the strength he needed. And they broke bread and shared one final meal together. And this time we remember that night. We remember that night that Jesus brought his disciples around him. And we call it communion because communion is what we do in community. We do together. And so this final time, before things were going to change horribly for Jesus, he brought his gathered disciples around a table with him in a room. And he took a loaf of bread, something that was the most basic food of life. He took a loaf of bread, it says, in the middle of the meal, he took the bread and he lifted up, said, "This which gives you life." And he broke it. And he says, "Just like this bread, I break this bread that gives you life. So will my body be broken for you so that you might experience life." And then he took a vase and he filled a cup. He said, "That which is in this cup, this represents my blood, which I will shed and give freely for the forgiveness of your sins." When you gather together and have communion, do this in remembrance of me. And they shared their meal together.